From now, Mariella Frostrup will be talking to the novelist Paul Tordet about his new book that's in Open Book here on BBC Radio 4, where now it's time for our new classic serial.
The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins, dramatised by Doug Lucy. Episode 1.
Cousin!
Please address me by my rank, Lieutenant.
I'm sorry. Captain Herncastle, I have our orders for tomorrow.
And they are?
When the town has been taken, we're to deploy to prevent any plunder and confusion following our victory.
Plunder, eh?
Yes, sir.
Khan! Khan!
Sir! Yes, sir.
Tell the Lieutenant what you were telling me earlier about the gem.
The Moonstone, sir?
That's the one.
It is very old, very sacred. It is a stone which shines even in the darkness.
But what is it?
It is a holy relic. Stolen from our sacred temple by the Muslim invaders long ago. It was protected by three guardian priests who followed and watched it in disguise, waiting the day when Vishnu the Preserver should restore to them their sacred gem. It now rests across the river in Seringapatam, set in the handle of a dagger among the choicest treasures in Sultan Tipu's armory.
And tomorrow we take Seringapatam, and I swear you will see the diamond in my hand when the day is done. I assure you, I'm in deadly earnest.
It's merely a fable.
We'll see.
Whoever holds the Moonstone will be cursed, and the guardian priest will be watching.
Dismiss, Khan!
Sir.
Superstitious savage.
Captain, our orders are specific.
Specific? In the heat of battle, with slaughter all around, orders will count for very little tomorrow, Lieutenant. You may take my word for that. Guardian priests.
You men! Leave those things where they are!
Get out of it!
Everything in this room is the property of the Crown! Do you hear me? Where is your captain?
He's in there.
Good God! Captain!
Someone in here!
Captain!
Clear the room! I set a guard on the door. I have it. Look, I have the diamond.
The Moonstone will have its vengeance yet on you and yours.
How did this man and these two others meet their deaths?
They met their deaths, as I suppose, by a mortal wound.
Is that all you have to tell me?
That is all.
I have no proof that you killed these three men, for I cannot say that my own eyes saw the deed committed. But it is my conviction that crime brings its own fatality with it. I am not only persuaded of your guilt, I even believe that you will live to regret it if you keep the diamond, and that others will regret taking it from you if you give it away.
I care nothing for the beliefs of any man, sir. So enough. I have here in my hand my heart's desire. You are dismissed, Lieutenant.
The diamond. Well, that takes us to Mr. Franklin Blake, who was the innocent means of bringing that unlucky jewel into this house. This house being that of my Lady Verinder, sister to the late John Herncastle. And Mr. Franklin being the son of my lady's oldest sister. He was recently returned to England from many years abroad, and I've not seen him since he were a boy. And he was the nicest boy that ever spun a top or broke a window. Now, back then, I was Gabriel Betteridge, farm bailiff. Now I am Gabriel Betteridge, house steward, in the service of Lady Julia Verinder and her daughter Rachel. There. And that's all the window's done. So, the diamond. Well, that Thursday was as fine a summer's day as ever you saw. And my lady and Miss Rachel, not expecting Mr. Franklin till dinner time, drove out to lunch. I was where I am now, approaching the main front doors, when I heard soft drumming and strange music from the terrace in front of my lady's residence. There stood three mahogany-coloured Indians in white linen frocks and trousers, playing a drum and other whatnots. Well, behind them stood a little delicate-looking English boy carrying a bag. Now, what's all this, may I ask?
Most respectfully, good sir. I present to you our group of Indian conjurers.
Stop.
We request most politely permission to perform in the presence of the lady of the house.
Dear.
Most respectfully, sir.
Well, respectfully or no, I have to inform you that the lady of the house is out. And I must ask you to leave these premises, gentlemen.
Of course, sir. As you wish.
I took up my beehive chair and set myself down on the sunny side of the terrace and fell not exactly into a sleep, but into the next best thing to it. I was roused up by my daughter Penelope running out at me as if the house were on fire.
Father!
What is it, my dear? What's got you so flushed?
Did you see three Indian men and a boy?
Yes, I did. And I sent them on their way.
Father, I say, have them arrested.
For what reason?
For this reason. Namely, that they knew who was coming from London to visit us and that they meant some mischief to Mr. Franklin Blake.
Explain yourself.
As I was coming by the lodge, I saw the three men with the boy. So I stole along the inner side of the hedge and watched them. They first looked up the road, then down the road, and made sure that they were alone. Then they all three faced about and stared hard in the direction of the house. Then they jabbered and disputed in their own language and looked at each other like men in doubt.
Boy, hold out your hand.
I don't like to.
Would you rather be sent back to London and left where we found you? Sleeping in a basket in the market, a hungry, ragged and forsaken little boy. Hold out your hand.
Very well.
The little chap unwillingly held out his hand, and upon that, the Indian took a bottle from his bosom and poured out of it some black stuff like ink into the palm of the boy's hand. He then touched the boy's head and made signs over it in the air, then said,
"Look, Deco."
And the boy became quite still and stood like a statue, looking into the ink in the hollow of his hand.
So far, it seems to be juggling, accompanied by a foolish waste of ink.
See the English gentleman from foreign parts?
I see him.
Is it on the road to this house and on no other that the English gentleman will travel today?
It is.
Has the English gentleman got it about him?
Yes.
Will the English gentleman come here as he has promised to come at the close of day?
I can't tell.
Why not?
I'm tired. The mist rises in my head and puzzles me. I can see no more today.
And with that, the Indian made more signs on the boy's head, then blew on his forehead and so woke him up with a start. Then they walked off into town and I saw no more of them. What did the man mean by has the English gentleman got it about him? What does it mean?
We'll ask Mr. Franklin, my dear, if he can wait till Mr. Franklin comes.
Yes, I can. And we'll see whether he thinks it a laughing matter.
I was just stretching my legs when out bounced another woman on me. Nancy, the kitchen maid.
Excuse me, Mr. Betteridge.
Betteridge.
What's up now, Nancy? Oh. What are you turning your back on your dinner for?
Rosanna's late again and I'm sent to fetch her in. All the hard work falls on my shoulders in this house.
Where is Rosanna?
At the Sands, of course. She had another of her fainting fits this morning and she has to go out and get a breath of fresh air. I have no patience with her.
Right, go back to your dinner, my girl. Oh. I have patience with her. I'll fetch her.
Thank you, sir.
Well, I took my stick and set off for the Sands. Rosanna was the only new servant in our house. About 4 months earlier, my lady had been in London and had gone over a reformatory, intended to save forlorn women from drifting back into bad ways after they got released from prison. The matron, seeing my lady took an interest in the place, pointed out a girl to her and told her a most miserable story.
Rosanna Spearman was a thief, badly used by her family and friends. But I am of the opinion that the girl is one in a thousand, and that she only wants a chance to prove herself worthy of any Christian woman's interest in her.
Then Rosanna Spearman shall have her chance in my service.
And a week afterwards, Rosanna entered this establishment as our second housemaid. And not a soul was told the girl's story excepting Miss Rachel and me. Now, our house is high up on the Yorkshire coast, close by the sea. We have got beautiful walks all round us in every direction, but one. This one. It leads through a melancholy plantation of firs and brings you out between low cliffs on the loneliest and ugliest little bay on all our coast. The sandhills here run down to the sea and end in two spits of rock. Between the two lies the most horrible quicksand, which shivers and trembles in a manner most remarkable to see, and which has given to it the name of the Shivering Sand. And it's true, account for it as you may, that this was Rosanna Spearman's favourite walk. And there she is, all alone, looking out on the quicksand and the sea. Come, come, my dear, what's all this? Come and sit down and tell me what you've been crying about.
About the years that are gone, Mr. Betteridge. My past life still comes back to me sometimes.
Your past life is all sponged out, my dear. Why can't you forget it, eh? Anyway, you're late for dinner, and I've come to fetch you in.
You, Mr. Betteridge?
They told Nancy to fetch you. I thought you might like your scolding better, my dear, if it come from me.
You're very kind, sir. I don't want any dinner today. Let me bide a little longer here.
What makes you like to be here in this miserable place, Rosanna?
Something draws me to it. I try to keep away from it and I can't. Sometimes I think that my grave is waiting for me here.
Now, lass.
Don't scold me. There's a dear good man. And please not to tell my lady I'm discontented. I am not. My mind's unquiet sometimes, that's all.
And now here's unwholesome talk.
Look at the quicksand, Mr. Betteridge. Do you know what it looks like to me? It looks as if it had hundreds of suffocating people under it, all struggling to get to the surface, and all sinking lower and lower in the dreadful deeps. Throw a stone in, Mr. Betteridge, and let's see the sand suck it down.
Here is an empty stomach feeding on an unquiet mind. Oh, my dear girl.
Betteridge!
Here?
Where are you?
You see who it is, girl?
Betteridge!
Who is it?
Did you recognise me, Betteridge?
Well, I owe you 7 and sixpence.
Now, do you know who I am?
Oh, blessed save us, Mr. Franklin Blake.
And who is this?
Rosanna, why do you blush so?
I'm sorry.
Be sure to eat some dinner.
That's an odd girl. I wonder what she sees in me to surprise her.
Well, I suppose, sir, it's that varnish from foreign parts.
Oh, well.
Oh, welcome back to the old place, Mr. Franklin. All the more welcome, sir, that you come some 4 hours before we expected you.
Oh, I have a reason for coming before you expected me. I suspect, Betteridge, that I've been followed and watched in London for the last 3 or 4 days, and I travelled by the morning instead of the afternoon train because I wanted to give a certain dark-looking stranger the slip. Tell me about the 3 Indians you had at the house today. It's just possible that my stranger and your 3 jugglers may turn out to be pieces of the same puzzle.
How do you come to know about the jugglers?
Well, I saw Penelope at the house. She told me of the 3 questions she'd overheard, and one in particular struck me. Has the English gentleman got it about him? Well, I suspect that it means this. And this, Betteridge, means my Uncle Herncastle's famous diamond.
Good Lord, sir.
Yeah.
How do you come to be in charge of the wicked Colonel's diamond?
Well, the wicked Colonel's will has left his diamond as an 18th birthday present to my cousin Rachel. And my father, as the wicked Colonel's executor, has given it in charge to me to bring down here.
The Colonel's diamond left to Miss Rachel? And your father, the Colonel's executor? Well, Adelaide, any bet you like that your father wouldn't have touched the Colonel with a pair of tongs.
You're of his time, Betteridge. Can you tell me anything against the Colonel?
Well, he was, I honestly believe, one of the greatest blackguards that ever lived. He had to leave the Guards before he were 22, and so off he went to India to try a little active service. It was at the taking of Seringapatam. He came back with a character that closed the doors of all his family agin him. My lady taking the lead and declaring that her brother should never enter any house of hers.
And what of his ownership of the diamond?
It was said in the family that he had got possession of his Indian jewel by means which, bold as he was, even he didn't dare acknowledge.
Did you ever meet him?
Why, once, about 2 years ago, at my lady's house in London. It was the occasion of Miss Rachel's birthday, and there was a party in honour of it, as usual. I received a message to say that a gentleman wanted to see me. Going up into the hall, there I found the Colonel, wasted and worn and as wild and wicked as ever I expected.
Go up to my sister and say that I have called to wish my niece many happy returns of the day.
Sir? Ah, here comes my lady. You may tell her yourself.
Hello, Julia.
Betteridge, tell Colonel Herncastle that Miss Verinder is engaged and that I decline to see him.
My lady and Miss Rachel regret that they are engaged, Colonel, and beg to be excused, having the honour of seeing you.
Thank you, Betteridge. I shall remember my niece's birthday.
And we heard no more of him until his death 6 months ago. But how do you come to be involved, sir?
Well, I believe there is a plot concerning the jewel. After his death, when we came to have the stone appraised, we found that his instructions were, in the event of his murder, for the jewel to be sent to Amsterdam, where it would be cut up into 4 or 6 separate stones.
But why?
Well, he tells the enemies he dreads, kill me and the diamond will be the diamond no longer. Its identity will be destroyed.
And who are these enemies he so dreads?
The Indians who originally owned the jewel. You see, it's a plot with some old Hindu superstition at the bottom of it. And the questions which we have to ask are, does the conspiracy against the Moonstone survive the Colonel's death? And did the Colonel know it when he left the birthday gift to his niece?
My lady and Miss Rachel.
Yeah.
Are they at the end of it all?
Well, upon my arrival, what is the first news that greets me? I find that 3 strolling Indians have been at the house and that my arrival and something which I am expected to have about me are 2 special objects of investigation to them when they believe themselves to be alone.
What do you think?
Oh, I think, sir, I should like to shove that diamond into the quicksand and settle the question in that way.
If you have £20,000 in your pocket, say so, Betteridge, and in it goes.
Aye.
But I don't want to alarm my aunt without reason, and I don't want to leave her without what may be a needful warning.
Yeah.
What would you do, Betteridge?
Wait.
Well, how long?
This is the 25th of May.
Yeah?
The birthday is on the 21st of June. We've got close on 4 weeks before us. Well, let's just wait and see what happens in that time.
But what's to be done with the diamond?
Your father put it in the safekeeping of a bank in London, sir. You've put it in the safekeeping of the bank at Frizinghall.
Yes.
If I were you, sir, I'd ride straight away with it to Frizinghall before the ladies come back.
Oh. Betteridge, you're worth your weight in gold. Come along. And saddle the best horse in the stables directly.
Daughter?
Father? What are you doing hovering there?
I've brought Mr. Franklin's brandy. How goes it?
Well, I have never known Miss Rachel so particular about the dressing of her hair as she was this evening. And I have never seen her look so bright and pretty as she did when she went down to meet Mr. Franklin.
How's Rosanna been this evening?
She returned to the house in a very unaccountable state of mind. She was turning all the colours of the rainbow. I surprised her, smiling and scribbling Mr. Franklin's name inside her workbox. Had she and he known anything of each other before today?
No, quite impossible. And I can speak to Mr. Franklin's astonishment as genuine when he saw how the girl stared at him.
Father, there's only one explanation of it. Rosanna has fallen in love with Mr. Franklin Blake at first sight.
What a ridiculous idea. She's a servant. And a most unattractive one at that.
I never knew you cruel before, Father.
Mr. Franklin's brandy and soda water, m'lady.
Ah, Betteridge. Dependable as ever.
Miss Rachel seems to have put the diamond clean out of your head, sir.
Yeah. She's the most charming girl I've seen since I came back to England. Thank you, Betteridge.
Sir. Intending to return to my quarters, I happened to glance out of the window at the grounds, which were brightly illuminated by a full moon, and saw the shadow of a person thrown forward from behind some bushes. I slipped out of the house, but I heard lighter feet than mine, and more than one pair of them, as I thought, retreating in a hurry to the shrubbery, from where they could easily make their way over our fence into the road. Passing over the walk where I'd seen the shadows, I now noticed a little bright object lying on the clean gravel. It was a small bottle containing a thick, sweet-smelling liquor, as black as ink. Mr. Franklin, sir?
Yes. What is it, Betteridge?
See what I found in the shrubbery, sir. It's that bottle of black ink belonging to the jugglers.
So, they're foolish enough to believe in their own magic, eh?
Yeah, it would appear so, sir.
Which means that the Indians took it for granted that we should keep the diamond here and brought their clairvoyant boy to show them the way to it.
Do you think they'll try against it?
Why, it depends. If the boy can see the diamond through the iron safe of the bank, we should be troubled with no more visits from the Indians for the present. If he can't, we shall have another chance of catching them in the shrubbery before many more nights have passed.
I waited pretty confidently for that latter chance, but strange to relate, it never came. And with no further intrusions by the Indians, the following month passed most pleasantly, with Miss Rachel and Mr. Franklin spending many happy hours in each other's company, which spurred my daughter Penelope on to much speculation.
Father, and Mr. Franklin still at their painting?
They are. And I confess it is nice to see them taking so much pleasure in each other's society.
They're a pretty match, wouldn't you say?
Oh, aye.
Do you suppose they might put their heads together with other objects in view besides the ornamenting of Miss Rachel's bedroom door? Might there be a wedding in the house before the summer is over?
Oh, entirely possible, my dear. Though I doubt whether her bridegroom will be Mr. Franklin Blake.
Who then?
Oh, well, just say that my lady has this day sent an invitation to a gentleman in London to come and help to keep Miss Rachel's birthday. Now, this is the fortunate individual on whom I believe her heart to be privately set. Like Mr. Franklin, he is a cousin of hers also.
Not Mr. Ablewhite.
The same. Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite. A barrister by profession, a ladies' man by temperament, and a good Samaritan by choice. He is the most accomplished philanthropist England ever produced. He loves everybody, and everybody loves him. What chance has Mr. Franklin, what chance has anybody of average reputation and capacities against such a man as this? Now, what do you say to that?
Poppycock.
Good.
June the 21st, the day of the birthday, was cloudy and unsettled at sunrise. After breakfast, we and the servants all began this happy anniversary, as usual, by offering our little presents to Miss Rachel.
Mr. Betteridge.
Mr. Franklin.
We must have a private conference concerning the moonstone.
Oh, yes, yes. Shall we go outside?
Now, it seems to me that nothing has happened to justify us in alarming my aunt on the subject of the jewel. And nothing can alter the legal obligation on me to put it in my cousin's possession. Do you agree?
You speak my mind precisely, sir.
Well, then I shall ride to Frizing Hall after lunch and bring the diamond back.
Right. Mr. Godfrey and his sisters are riding over from Frizing Hall this afternoon. Well, they could, in all probability, keep you company on the way home again.
Perfect.
Betteridge, how are you, my dear old friend?
Wearing well, I see.
Thank you, Mr. Godfrey. And I hope you found your father in good health.
Yes, much as usual.
Uh-huh. And my two beautiful Miss Ablewhites, welcome.
Mr. Betteridge, hello.
Hello. Oh, where is Rachel? I have to see her.
Miss Ablewhite.
She's indoors, miss. Please to enter and seek her out.
Oh, hide and seek.
Oh, I love hide and seek.
Shall we dawdle for the sake of our eardrums?
Oh, would you go on, sir? I need a word with Mr. Franklin.
Oh, very well.
Sir. Oh. Have you the diamond safe, sir?
Yes. Oh.
And have you seen anything of the Indians?
Not a glimpse. Where is Lady Julia?
Sit in the drawing room with Miss Rachel. Which hiding place, I fear, the Miss Ablewhites have just discovered.
Now, I must speak to Rachel.
Sir. I busied myself in the vicinity of the drawing room until an outbreak of screams from the Miss Ablewhites alerted me to the probability of the diamond having been produced. So I went in, on pretense of asking for instructions about the dinner. Oh, Lord. Bless us, miss, that is a diamond. It's as large as a plover's egg.
Look into the stone.
Ooh, as unfathomable as the heavens themselves.
And it still shines when I cup it in my hands. See?
Unfathomable.
Betteridge, will you come to my room shortly?
Of course, my lady. Oh, Miss Rachel. What a gem.
Carbon, Betteridge. Make carbon, my good friend.
I have an army of waiters to marshal downstairs, sir. Please excuse me.
Dear old Betteridge, I have the truest regard for him.
He was embracing his sisters and ogling Miss Rachel while he honoured me with that testimony of affection. Something like a stock of love to draw on there. Mr. Franklin, slumped all this time morosely in a chair, was a perfect savage by comparison with him.
Gabriel, you know well my feelings towards my late brother John, do you not?
I do, my lady, and I share them.
Very well. I take the blackest view possible of the Colonel's motives in this matter of the diamond. I am bent on getting the Moonstone out of my daughter's possession at the first opportunity.
I understand.
I want you to pay her special attention while she has the diamond about her person. Keep close by her, Gabriel, at all times, until the Moonstone is safely deposited again in the bank tomorrow.
I shall, my lady, and when I am of necessity called away to attend to house business, I shall instruct the footman to maintain a vigil by Miss Rachel's side.
Be sure he does mind. That will be all.
Thank you, my lady. Then it was time for me to smarten myself up for receiving the company. At which time my daughter Penelope presented herself, on pretense of brushing what little hair I have got left, and improving the tie of my white cravat.
Ow!
News for you, Father. Miss Rachel has refused him.
Who's him?
The ladies' committee, ma'am, Father. A nasty, sly fellow. I hate him for trying to supplant Mr. Franklin.
Ow!
I saw him take her away alone into the rose garden. And I waited behind the holly to see how they came back. They had gone out arm in arm, both laughing. They came back, walking separate, as grave could be, and looking straight away from each other. There's one woman in the world who can resist Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite at any rate. If I was a lady, I should be another.
Oh, this'll keep, girl. Company's arriving. Come on.
There is no need to worry you with a list of the guests. You'll meet none of them a second time, in my part of the story at any rate, with the exception of two.
Miss Rachel, did the diamond then come in this setting?
Mr. Candy, our local doctor.
No. Mr. Franklin has contrived with his neat fingers and a little bit of silver wire how to fix it as a brooch. Oh, yes. Isn't it wonderful?
Truly it is.
The other guest was an eminent public character, being no other than the celebrated traveller in India, Mr. Murthwaite, who, at the risk of his life, had penetrated in disguise where no European had ever set foot before.
If you ever go to India, Miss Verinder, don't take your uncle's birthday gift with you. I know a certain city and a certain temple in that city where, dressed as you are now, your life would not be worth 5 minutes' purchase.
Really? Oh, how exciting!
After inquiring of his neighbour, Mr. Franklin, just how he had contrived the Moonstone brooch, Mr. Candy inexplicably fell into a dispute with Mr. Franklin over the latter's recent lack of sleep.
See, your nerves are all out of order due to your recent resolution to give up your cigars, and you should go through a course of medicine immediately.
I've never heard such arrogant nonsense. Oh. You play God, sir. You would make us all helpless infants, Doctor. Ailments that have
gentlemen, I forbid this dispute to go on any further.
Apologies, Lady Verinder.
Yes, mine also.
Ladies, we may leave the gentlemen to their wives.
Excuse me.
Now, what nefariousness was this? Here were the jugglers returning to us with the return of the Moonstone to the house.
Oh, how exciting! Come, everyone, on the terrace with the
Mr. Franklin got on one side of Miss Rachel, and I put myself behind her. If our suspicions were right, there she stood innocent of all knowledge of the truth, showing the Indians the diamond in the bosom of her dress.
Namaskar, bhaiya.
Namaskar.
But what with this? Mr. Murthwaite came quietly behind the jugglers and spoke to them on a sudden in the language of their own country. The chief Indian thereupon wheeled about again toward the gentlefolk.
My lady, I regret to inform you our exhibition is now finished, and we thank you for your kindness.
Footman, see these gentlemen off the premises.
Yes, sir, Mr. Betteridge.
All right, come on.
Must they be sent away, Mama?
Yes, they must. Come along inside. The evening's turning colder.
I followed at a discreet distance to ensure that the Indians were truly gone. Then, going back to the house by way of the shrubbery, I found Mr. Franklin and Mr. Murthwaite walking slowly up and down among the trees.
Ah, Betteridge. I've been telling Mr. Murthwaite the whole story of how the jewel came into my hand.
Ah, Mr. Betteridge, those three Indians are no more jugglers than you and I are.
No?
Have you met with them before?
Never. But I know what Indian juggling really is. All you have seen tonight is a very bad and clumsy imitation of it. Those men are high-caste Brahmins, and when I charged them with being disguised, you saw how it told on them.
Aye.
There is a mystery about their conduct that I can't explain. They have doubly sacrificed their caste, first in crossing the sea, secondly in disguising themselves as jugglers. There must be some very serious motive at the bottom of it.
And what does your experience say?
My experience says that you have had more narrow escapes of your life, Mr. Franklin Blake, than I have had of mine. And that is saying a great deal.
Is it really as serious as that?
I can't doubt that the restoration of the moonstone to its place on the forehead of the Indian idol is the motive. Those men will wait their opportunity with the patience of cats and will use it with the ferocity of tigers.
You don't really mean to say, sir, that they would have taken Mr. Franklin's life to get that diamond if he'd given them a chance.
I do, sir. If 1,000 lives stood between them and the getting back of their diamond, they would take them all.
Lord.
The sacrifice of caste is a serious thing in India.
Yeah.
The sacrifice of life is nothing at all.
Then they are a set of murdering thieves.
On the contrary, they are a wonderful people.
But they have seen the moonstone on Miss Verinder's dress. So what is to be done?
What your uncle threatened to do. Send the diamond tomorrow to be cut up in Amsterdam. There is an end of its sacred identity as the moonstone, and there is an end of the conspiracy.
Betteridge, we must speak to Lady Verinder tomorrow.
But what about tonight, sir? Suppose the Indians come back?
No, yes. I don't think they would risk coming back tonight.
You suppose the rogues are bolder than you think?
In that case, let the dogs loose. The Mastiff and the Bloodhound have one great merit. They are not likely to be troubled with your scruples about the sanctity of human life. Besides, by the look of that sky, the Indians will want their umbrellas tonight.
Yes. I think we'd better be going in.
2 or so hours later, when the guests had driven away in the pouring rain, I went back into the inner hall and found Godfrey Ablewhite at the side table presiding over the brandy and soda water as my lady and Miss Rachel came out of the drawing room, followed by Mr. Franklin.
Rachel, where are you going to put your diamond tonight?
On my dressing table, along with my other things. Oh, except it might take to shining of itself in the dark and terrify me in the dead of night. I know. I shall put the Indian diamond in my Indian cabinet for the purpose of letting 2 beautiful native productions admire each other.
My dear, your Indian cabinet has no lock on it.
Oh, good heavens, Mama. Is this an hotel? Are there thieves in the house?
Why not let me keep the diamond for you tonight?
No, it is mine and it shall stay by me.
Come into my room, Rachel, the first thing tomorrow morning. I shall have something to say to you. Good night, gentlemen.
Good night, huh?
Good night.
Good night, Mr. Godfrey.
Good night.
Good night, Mr. Franklin.
Good night, Rachel.
And thank you so much for my wonderful birthday present.
Will you be having a brandy and soda water, Mr. Franklin?
No, thank you.
Sir? You should, you know. Here, I'll pour one for you. It's always a good idea to take something before retiring.
All right. Good night.
Good night. Good night, Betteridge. Good
night. And with that, the evening was finally over. The dogs were running loose, the rain was beating down, and all the doors and windows were safely locked as I climbed the stairs to my well-earned night's rest.
Father, come downstairs for God's sake. The diamond is gone.
Are you out of view?
The diamond is gone. It's gone. Nobody knows how. Come down and see.
I dressed myself quickly and made my way to Miss Rachel's rooms. There on the threshold stood Miss Rachel, almost as white in the face as the white dressing gown that clothed her. There also stood the 2 doors of the Indian cabinet, wide open. One of the drawers inside was pulled out as far as it would go.
Father, Will. Father, look. I myself saw Miss Rachel put the diamond into that drawer last night.
Is this true, Miss?
The diamond is gone. The diamond is gone.
Oh, my God.
Betteridge, what on earth is going on?
My lady,
The diamond's gone.
Rachel? Rachel, let me in. I have to speak to you.
What's all the fuss?
The diamond's gone.
Gone?
Aye.
Franklin, do you hear? The diamond's gone.
How? As yet, sir, nobody knows.
Oh, damn. I've had my first good night's sleep since forswearing cigars, and so I failed to stop this conspiracy.
The Indians, do you think, sir?
Who else, Petteridge? Who else?
Has a thorough search been carried out?
We've looked everywhere in the room, sir, and there's no sign of it.
I must speak to Rachel.
Aunt Julia.
The loss of the diamond seems to have quite overwhelmed my daughter. It is impossible you can see her for the present.
Well, is there nothing we can do for her?
Oh, she shrinks in the strangest manner from speaking of it, even to me. I suppose I have no alternative but to send for the police.
Yes. And the first thing for the police to do is to lay hands on the Indian jugglers who performed here last night.
What do you mean?
I can't stop to explain myself now. But give me your permission, my lady, and I will ride to Frizing Hall and present myself to the magistrate there, informing him that I represent your interests and wishes. Our chances of catching the thieves may depend on our not wasting one unnecessary minute.
Very well, since you are so certain.
Samuel! Prepare a horse for Mr. Franklin straight away!
Yes, sir.
A little before 11, Mr. Franklin came back. That resolute side of him had, to all appearances, given way in the interval since his departure. He had left us at a gallop. He came back to us at a walk. Well, are the police coming?
Yes. But the case is hopeless.
You mean the Indians have escaped?
The poor, ill-used Indians have been most unjustly put in prison. They're as innocent as the babe unborn.
How come?
Well, all three were seen returning to Frizing Hall with their boy last night between 10 and 11. Later still, at midnight, the police, having occasion to search the common lodging house where they lived, saw them all three again, and their little boy with them as usual. There is not even a case of suspicion against them so far. However, the worthy magistrate's an old friend of my aunt's and has committed the Indians to prison for a week.
So if the jugglers are innocent, who in the name of wonder took the moonstone out of Miss Rachel's drawer?
I have no answer for you, Betteridge. None at all.
A few minutes later, three policemen arrived, a Superintendent Seagrave and two constables. We need not detain ourselves with his inquiries, such as they were, since they came to nothing. Mr. Franklin declared the superintendent an ass, while Mr. Godfrey considered him a most competent person. The superintendent's supposition that one of our servants was the culprit only enraged most of the staff, while his clear indication that his main suspicion was of my own dear daughter enraged me. The only matter he established as fact was that somebody had smeared the decorative paintwork on Miss Rachel's door, probably, he surmised, when the servants invaded the room in protest at his actions. Miss Rachel refused point blank to speak to the superintendent, but suddenly appeared among us as, yet again, we searched her rooms.
Penelope, Mr. Franklin Blake sent you with a message from me this morning.
Yes, miss.
He wished to speak to me, didn't he?
Yes, miss.
Where is he now?
Mr. Franklin is on the terrace, miss.
Oh, Miss Rachel.
Carry on, Penelope.
I couldn't help looking out of the window when Miss Rachel met the gentleman outside. She went up to Mr. Franklin without appearing to notice Mr. Godfrey, who thereupon drew back and left them by themselves. What she said to Mr. Franklin appeared to be spoken vehemently, and judging by what I saw of his face, seemed to astonish him beyond all power of expression. Miss Rachel then came back inside, locked herself in her room, and began crying. In a rage one moment, in tears the next. What did it mean? Well, Miss Rachel wasn't the only one who had seemed to have been turned by the business with her diamond either.
Rosanna?
Now, what might you want in the library at this time of day, Miguel? You know you're not supposed to be in there.
Mr. Franklin Blake dropped one of his rings upstairs. I've been into the library to give it to him.
Mm. Well, all right. Get back to your work.
Yes.
Ah, Bessridge.
Sir?
I need a conveyance to the railway station.
Are you going to London, sir?
I'm going to telegraph to London. I've convinced my aunt that we must have a cleverer head than Superintendent Seagraves to help us.
Aye.
My father knows the Chief Commissioner of Police, and the Commissioner can lay hands on the right man to solve the mystery of the diamond.
Good plan, sir.
Talking of mysteries, either Rosanna Spearman's head is not quite right, or I'm afraid she knows more about the Moonstone than she ought to know.
Oh, what makes you say so?
Well, she came in here with a ring I dropped in my bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
When I thanked her, I expected her to go. Instead of that, she stood opposite me at the table, looking at me in the oddest manner, half frightened, half familiar. I couldn't make it out.
This is a strange thing about the diamond, sir.
Yes, it is.
They will never find the diamond, sir, will they? No. Nor the person who took it. I'll answer for that.
Then hearing your step outside, she changed colour and left the room. What on earth does it mean?
I've no idea, sir.
I can't bear the idea of getting the poor girl into a scrape merely because she has a flighty way with her and talks very strangely, and yet if she had said to the superintendent what she said to me, I'm afraid she...
The best way, sir, will be for me to say two words privately to my mistress about it. My lady has a very friendly interest in Rosanna, and the girl may only have been a bit forward and foolish after all.
Oh, thank you, Betteridge.
Sir.
Father.
What is it, my dear?
I thought I should tell you. Rosanna's been suddenly taken ill and gone upstairs to her own room to lie down.
Curious. She looked well enough when I saw her not 10 minutes ago. Look, keep an eye out for her. There's a good girl.
I will.
We will make as light of this as we can before my aunt, but it is a more important matter than you may suppose.
Well, it is a matter of £20,000, sir.
It's a matter of quieting Rachel's mind. I'm very uneasy about her. Now, I must send the telegram.
The Thursday night passed and nothing happened. With the Friday morning, though, came news. The baker's man declared to Penelope that he had met Rosanna Spearman on the previous afternoon, with a thick veil on, walking towards Frizinghall by the footpath over the moor. It seems strange that anybody should be mistaken about Rosanna, but mistaken the man must have been, for Rosanna, as you know, had been all the Thursday afternoon ill upstairs in her room. Of more pressing import was the telegram which arrived in reply to Mr. Franklin's of the previous day. Mr. Franklin, sir, this may be of interest.
Splendid. Excellent. The Commissioner has laid hands on the right man to help us, a man by the name of Sergeant Cuff, and he'll be arriving on the morning train.
Do you know this man, Cuff, sir?
Well, only by reputation. But if half the stories I've heard are true, when it comes to unravelling a mystery, there isn't the equal in England of Sergeant Cuff.
Splendid.
I begin to hope we are seeing the end of our anxieties already.
When the time came for the sergeant's arrival, I went down to the gate to look out for him. A fly from the railway drove up as I reached the lodge, and out got a grizzled elderly man, so miserably lean that he looked as if he'd not got an ounce of flesh on his bones in any part of him.
Is this Lady Verinder's?
Yes, sir.
I'm Sergeant Cuff.
This way, sir, if you please.
Now, these grounds are very nice. The sea air is very brisk and refreshing.
Yes, sir.
You have a rose garden.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah, you've got the right exposure here to the south and southwest. Yeah, this is the shape for a rosary. Nothing like a circle set in a square with walks between all the beds, but they oughtn't to be gravel walks like these. Grass walks between your roses. Gravel's too hard for them.
You seem to be very fond of roses, Sergeant.
Well, I haven't much time to be fond of anything, Mr...
Betteridge, sir.
But when I have a moment's fondness to bestow, most times, Mr. Betteridge, the roses get it. I began my life among them in my father's nursery garden, and I shall end my life among them if I can.
Ah. Well, it seems an odd taste, sir, for a man in your line of life.
Does it? Now, show me, if you will, the room from which the diamond disappeared. What did the superintendent make of this, then, Betteridge?
Very little, sir. Save for the smear in the paint there on the door. He supposed that to have been done by one of the servants when they all crowded into the room.
Did he now? What time was that?
11 on Thursday morning, sir. He said one of their petticoats must have done it.
Did he say which one?
No, sir.
Is there anybody in the house who knows whether that paint was wet or dry at 11 yesterday morning?
Well, her ladyship's nephew, Mr. Franklin Blake, knows. He's just across the hall. Shall I call him?
If you wouldn't mind it.
Sir. Mr. Franklin, sir, are you there?
Yes?
Mr. Franklin? Sergeant Cuff has arrived, sir.
Ah, good news, at last. Pleased to meet you, Sergeant.
Yes, sir. What can you tell me about this door? How long would this paint have taken to dry?
Well, the door's been painted by Miss Verinder under my inspection and with my help. It's in a vehicle of my own composition. Hmm. The vehicle dries, whatever colours may be used with it, in 12 hours.
Do you remember when the smear bit was done, sir?
Perfectly. That was the last morsel of the door to be finished. Was it by 3 in the afternoon or soon after?
So, at 3 on the Wednesday afternoon, that bit of the painting was completed. The vehicle dried it in 12 hours. That is to say, by 3 o'clock on Thursday morning. At 11 on Thursday morning, the superintendent held his inquiry here. Yeah. Take 3 from 11 and 8 remains. That paint had been 8 hours dry when the superintendent supposed that the women servants' petticoats smeared it. It's quite on the card, sir, that you have put the clue into our hands.
Did you say that he had put the clue into your hands?
This is Miss Verinder, Sergeant.
That gentleman, miss, has possibly put the clue into our hands. Having answered your question, miss, I beg leave to make an inquiry in my turn. There is a smear on the painting of your door here. Do you happen to know when it was done or who did it?
Are you another police officer?
I am Sergeant Cuff, miss, of the detective police.
Do you think a young lady's advice worth having?
I should be glad to hear it, miss.
Do your duty by yourself and don't allow Mr. Franklin Blake to help you.
Thank you, miss. Do you happen to know anything about the smear? Might you have done it by accident yourself?
I know nothing about the smear.
Rachel. I told you I was uneasy about her, Betteridge. Now you can see why.
Miss Verinder appears to be a little out of temper with the loss of her diamond. Natural enough, it's a valuable jewel. But let us forget what has passed and go on with this business. Who was the last person in the room, the last thing on Wednesday night?
Miss Rachel, I suppose, sir.
Or possibly your daughter, Betteridge.
My daughter is Miss Rachel's maid, Sergeant.
Then perhaps you will ask her to step up.
Yes, sir.
But please inform her and the rest of the servants of two things. First, that I have no evidence before me yet that the diamond has been stolen. I only know that the diamond has been lost. Second, that my business here with the servants is simply to ask them to lay their heads together and help me to find it.
Yeah. May I make so bold as to tell the women a third thing, sir? Yeah. The superintendent confined them to their quarters. May I now tell them that they're free to fidget up and downstairs and whisk in and out of their bedrooms if the fit takes them?
Perfectly free.
Oh, that will smooth them down. From the cook to the scullion.
Go and do it at once, Mr. Betteridge.
I did it in less than 5 minutes. The sergeant seemed to approve of Penelope. He became a trifle less dreary, and he looked much as he had looked when he saw our rose garden. When he was done with Penelope, the sergeant examined the smeared paint with a magnifying glass.
No skin mark as of a human hand printed off on the paint. All the signs visible tell me that the paint has been smeared by some loose article of somebody's dress touching it and going by. That somebody must have been in the room and done the mischief between midnight and 3 o'clock on Thursday morning. So, we must first discover if there is an article of clothing with the paint smear on it anywhere in the house. Then we must find out who that dress belongs to, and finally, we must find out how the person can account for having been in this room and smeared the paint between the hours in question. If the person cannot satisfy us, then we shan't have far to look for the hand that has got the diamond. Mr. Betteridge, I should like 10 minutes' conversation with your mistress at her ladyship's earliest convenience.
I'll arrange it.
Sergeant, can you guess who has stolen the diamond yet?
Nobody has stolen the diamond.
What do you mean?
How can that be?
Wait a little. The pieces of the puzzle are not all put together yet.
In episode 1 of The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins, Lady Verinder was played by Eleanor Bron, Sergeant Cuff by Kenneth Cranham, Franklin Blake by Paul Rees, Rachel Verinder by Jasmine Hyde, and Betteridge by Steve Hodson. John Herncastle was played by Stephen Critchlow, Godfrey Ablewhite by Mark Straker, Rosanna Spearman by Alison Pettit, Mr. Murthwaite by Paul Bhattacharjee, Penelope by Claire Corbett, The Indian by Narinda Samra, The Housemaid by Carolyn Pickles, and The Little Boy by Alex Miller. The Moonstone was recorded on location by Lucinda Mason Brown, with original music by David Chilton. It was dramatised by Doug Lucy and produced by Janet Whittaker. The Moonstone was a Goldhawk Essential production for BBC Radio 4.
And The Moonstone continues at the same time next Sunday. After the news, Sue Arnold will be reviewing the latest crop of audiobooks, that's in Open Book. But first, a word from Rory Kethlen-Jones.
Maybe you've heard of a little company called Facebook, or maybe you've sent out a tweet today. But where did social networking come from? We'll travel all the way back to California in the 1970s, where hippies met hackers. We'll trace the phenomenon through earthquakes, revolutions, and big business feuds. And we'll find out what happens next. That's The Secret History of Social Networking with me, Rory Kethlen-Jones, this Wednesday morning at 11, here on BBC Radio 4.